Today on the podcast, we have my friend Sam Thomas, who is a colleague in the religion department who has worked on the ancient texts known as the Dead Sea Scrolls from what is today ancient Israel. And he has turned his attention to a new book recently on nature, creativity, and community. Hope you enjoy it. Well, what I want to know is, why are the sea scrolls dead?
You know, this is funny. Like, this whole time, I was sure that they were Dead Sea squirrels. And I was
there
like,
were squirrels?
Yeah, but it turns out there are these things called scrolls.
What is that? Is that like a book?
A scroll is not a book. Oh. No. That is precisely the point, is that these are not books. These are scrolls. These are independent compositions that later will be put into a book, but they're not books.
Yeah. So, Dead Sea Scrolls... So, the Qumran community, which is living at the Dead Sea, is there, what, a couple hundred years before Christ, or?
Mm-hmm. Not quite at Qumran. It's possible that the community out of which, or the communities out of which the inhabitants of Qumran kind of grew, or with which they were affiliated, predated the site, right? It's likely that they did. But the actual inhabitation of the site of Qumran, according to archaeological records, is likely around, you know, starts around 100 or so.
CE?
BCE.
Oh, BCE.
Yeah. And then the site will be inhabited with a couple of interruptions over the course of the next 165, 170 years.
But the people who end up at Qumran, where they find the scrolls, mm-hmm. not the squirrels, the scrolls.
There may have been squirrels.
There may have been.
Maybe that's why these things are so fragmentary. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not worms.
not
squirrels.
So much
squirrels.
No, rats, probably.
The squirrels had them.
Rats and bugs and Roman soldiers.
The reason that these scrolls are found there is that these people end up in Qumran, but you're saying they could have left the main civilizational kind of... organization, whatever cities, like mm-hmm. Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
what, 20 years earlier or 100 years earlier?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on how we read the sources. It's quite clear that there are communities that will sort of remove themselves from participation in everyday society in the ways that's, you know, that's sort of typical. But then they also, it depends on how we understand how they tell their own stories. Like if we read one of the main texts which was discovered there, one of the important kind of community texts is one called the Damascus Document, and that text tells the story of the origin of the sect kind of reaching all the way back into into Babylonian captivity,
right?
But like whether like but they're not telling a story that most modern historians would accept as
right
historical, but rather kind of like it's the myth of the sectarian origins. So it depends on how we read those sources, but I think it's safe to say that there are groups in the maybe as early as the 2nd century, maybe even as early as the 3rd century BCE, that are removing themselves from regular participation in social and religious and economic life and constructing alternative kinds of communities. And maybe even within the context of mainstream society.
Are they leaving... Right. Society all up and down Israel and Judah at that point, or just Jerusalem?
There are some, again, according to sources, there are some that live in camps and some uh-huh. that live in cities. And
oh, okay,
and it really just depends on how we read the sources. The connection with Qumran appears to be. I mean, you know, there's obviously quite a bit of controversy about this, but the connection with Qumran appears to be that a certain faction of a movement, which later writers like Josephus will call the Essenes,
mm-hmm.
But modern scholars tend to prefer to use a word like Yachad, which is the word that they actually used to refer
that
to
themselves. That they used for themselves, yeah.
That a portion of that group inhabited the site of Qumran, and it's possible that the site of Qumran became a kind of center of the movement, or a place where some of the more elite members would have
so it was a somewhat stratified society in terms
very
of
very stratified society. If you look at the different rule texts, especially what's called the community rule,
yeah,
but others as well, there are it's very, very clear what the hierarchical arrangement is supposed to be, and new members were sort of rigorously tested and examined and had to go through a whole process by which they could enter into the community. So you couldn't even really fully participate in the life of the community for at least 2 years.
So why would these people, why did the text say that these people wanted to leave the societies that they were a part of?
Well, that's there again, it's a complicated question, and there are some different theories about that. Most of them pertain to the temple in Jerusalem and how the temple is being run. So if you look at, for example, a text called, modern scholars called 4QMMT, which appears to be some kind of letter.
That's a great name.
Yeah, it stands for K4 from Qumran. Mikzat Maaseh HaTorah in Hebrew, which means some works of the law.
So you say. So, yeah, I'll take your word for it
if you want. Yeah. and in that text, there's a, it's a portion of that appears to be kind of like a letter, although again, people are kind of complicating how we should understand this. And there are some statements there that indicate that whoever was responsible for writing that text had some disagreements with the priestly officials in and around the temple about how the temple was being run, about the, you know, the use of the calendar, and the kinds of sacrifices that were being done.
People weren't doing their job right according to the person who wrote this letter.
Exactly right. And so we can see from multiple different perspectives, even if these represent different groups that have been removing themselves and maybe they're aligned in some way, most of the disagreements and most of the reasons why people will sort of remove themselves have to do with the temple and probably
so protesting against
the temple.
It's a social protest.
It's social, but it's, I think, probably also economic.
Oh, protest.
The temple is the center of economic life, and this is a way of creating an alternative economy, an alternative religious kind of religious system.
I sometimes want to do that in my life.
Oh yeah, no, there are a lot of interesting overlaps, of course, with kind of like sectarian or resistance movements in later European society, in early American culture, and probably, you know, in other religious and social settings as well. So in some ways, like the kinds of things that they seem worried about aren't really all that new, just a different.
Yeah.
Different setting, different configuration.
But these writings are important because they tell us about a really formative time in human history.
At least in Jewish history.
In Jewish history.
In
what ends up becoming.
Understanding early Christianity.
Christian history.
Yeah.
So the early work on these texts in the mid-20th century to late 20th century was just figuring out what the heck was in them from just a basic textual standpoint, right?
That's right.
And then you represent like a second wave, maybe your work represents a second or third wave.
That's right. Yep.
In that, so what do you do with these texts? How do you approach them? That's different than your advisor, your mentors before you.
No, that's a good question.
I only ask good questions.
You specialize in good questions. The first, the scrolls were discovered, and the first cave was discovered in really actually in 1947, but in kind of these things started coming out in 1948, and over the course of the next 9 years, different caves were discovered, and there was just a lot of fragmentary manuscripts. We're talking about, 11 caves and over 16,000 fragments, especially from one cave, Cave 4. That had the most of them, and the work of reconstructing the manuscripts was just an unbelievably
took decades
monumental task.
Yeah,
and, you look at some of the work that these guys did, and it was controversial because some people thought it was taking too long, and some people thought there were conspiracies. And
right,
but in my own view, while there were certainly problems with the way the team was sort of managed and the way that the work was being done, the biggest problem was that it just was extremely tedious and difficult work that required the kinds of disciplinary expertise that very few people have.
Yeah.
It took a long time to actually figure out, what the manuscripts said, like how to actually piece them together.
And they were based on a discovery. I mean, these guys didn't see this coming. Could you imagine being a scholar and all of a sudden having this whole new set of data
exactly
to work with that has been there, but not in...
Well, and a whole new set of data that has really profound both religious and political, yeah. you know, implications.
Yeah.
And to be kind of caught up in that.
Yeah.
Is
no not small
not something that I envy. I mean, I feel fortunate to be part of the the second wave of you know the second generation of scholars who work on this stuff because I you know I don't have to worry too much about some of those things.
Yeah. But
because for the most part now we know what they say, yeah. even though people will continue to kind of you know argue about some of the details and sure. reconstructions. We generally know what they say, and now the work is over the last you know 15, 20 years has been to really try to figure out what they mean. Like how do we actually, you know, understand what contribution these scrolls are making to our understanding both of early Judaism, but also of the history of the biblical text and kind of the background of earliest Christianity.
And so your work was on looking at the concept of mystery mm-hmm. in these texts. And you mm-hmm. put mysteries in air quotes in there. So in the title, right? The Mysteries
yeah.
of Qumran?
Yeah, yeah.
So why the Mysteries of Qumran, Dr. Thomas?
Well, because I think that we always have to be really careful with how we use terms, especially when we're doing translation. And something like a word for mystery or a concept of mystery does not translate directly from one cultural context to another mm-hmm. very easily. And so mm-hmm. I was trying to kind of be really careful about the kinds of assumptions that I was making about that kind of, you know, the correspondence between terms. So, like, there had already been a lot of work done on mystery religions in mm-hmm. the Greco-Roman period.
Right.
And
this was actually, there was a large phenomenon. A
pretty of course, widespread yeah, a very widespread
of things called, quote-unquote, mystery religions.
That's right, in different cultural settings.
Right.
Like Egypt and
around the Mediterranean.
Persia, and mm-hmm. exactly, around the Mediterranean world. And I was trying to avoid some of the, like, the kind of the creep, you know, the creeping that goes on, the slippage.
Right.
Sloppiness, right? Yeah. So I really was trying to say, okay, when I'm talking about mystery language, here are exactly the things that I'm talking about.
Right.
And here are the things that I'm not talking about.
Right.
Where, that we don't see in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
But also, you know, trying to open up that space where we could start to see that the ways of speaking about mystery do actually connect with what we find in other cultural settings in Babylonian and Persian Aramaic speaking circles.
That's exciting.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of a new insight into how to understand some of this material. But that it also points to a kind of, you know, a kind of esotericism or a way of thinking about secret knowledge.
Yeah.
And not just like what is secret knowledge, like what do you actually know?
Yeah.
But what are the functions of secret knowledge? How does secret knowledge actually serve to create social boundaries? How does it serve to constitute a kind of discourse for a community that's trying to separate itself from, you know, mainstream society?
Yeah.
So I'm really more interested in the kind of second order question.
Yeah.
What does that actually do? Like, what action does that have
in
kind of lived experience?
Well, it's really tricky because the texts are, as you said, already somewhat controversial, and they have this history, and then you're talking about mystery and secrecy in the middle of that, and even the dating of a lot of these things is a kind of a house of cards.
Yep, yep.
And then you're dealing with esotericism,
mm-hmm.
which you sort of have to read against the grain to figure out what the heck is going on, right? When people are telling secrets, they're not going to be
they're not telling
by
you
nature.
exactly what you want to know, right?
Right.
Well, it sounds like you actually read my book, so don't answer that.
There's a Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's precisely right, and I think that's an interesting, you know, kind of paradox or problem for the study of any esoteric tradition. Is in some ways you have to be in the club.
Yeah.
In order to know what the heck you're talking about.
Because that's what mysteries and secrets do, right?
That's
they create ins and outs.
That's right. And that's partly why kind of my interest in not necessarily saying here's exactly what the secrets were, but here's how mystery and secrecy function.
That's excellent.
Within the, you know, within the kind of broader kind of social and linguistic setting.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
But you've moved on. I mean, you've changed.
Moved on, yep.
I mean, you're still very much, it seems like, a part of the the larger Qumran studies mm-hmm. circle, and you have a network there. But it seems like your heart pulled you towards a different set of questions altogether.
Yeah.
Attention.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
What is attention? What are you doing with that?
I ponder this once in a while. I think there are some connections that one could draw between the stuff that I have been thinking about for a while around mystery and mm-hmm. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the work that I'm still doing in that area in the Dead Sea Scrolls has to do with kind of the language of sense perception,
right?
And how we might think about the connections between text or textual communities and experience.
So the texts are saying certain things. In ways that speak to issues about hearing and mm-hmm. and sight.
Exactly.
And they might be creating certain kinds of communities in what they're talking That's about right. because of what they're talking about.
That's right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and so a lot of the things that I started noticing when I was working on that project, the Mysteries project, was has served but didn't really include in that project has served as the basis for this other work that I'm doing now. And while I would say there's not a direct relationship between that project and this other one, I think that you were referring to just now, the project on attention or attentiveness, I do think that there's something kind of probably behind my interest in both of those. And I'll talk more about that in a minute, but I haven't really put my finger on
right.
exactly what that is, at this point. But the project on attention or attentiveness derives out of my interest in three things. One of them is nature and kind of environment or ecology, and I've been teaching environmental ethics here at CLU for about the last 5 years, and
very popular course.
And yeah, really yeah. fun course and great, and it's required for our environmental science majors, and
which is a new major,
relatively new. Yeah, 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 exactly. And that kind of that connects to my own background. You know, I studied ecology and environmental ethics as an undergrad, and had the opportunity to teach environmental ethics here. And so that's been a really kind of great new source of my own, my own intellectual life. The second thing is woodworking or craft, and the human creative impulse. And so I was interested in that and probing that. I'm an avid woodworker and furniture maker, and so
and a good one.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. You're kind for all your listeners.
Yeah, get your orders in now.
I am taking orders if you're patient and
we're ready to go with that table, that dining table right. outside. We want it with the bench and everything. All right. Yeah.
And then the third thing was is my interest in community and in some of the kind of contemporary experiences of dislocation and alienation and fragmentation of community life, and wanting to think about what does community mean now? And of course, like that's a question that connects directly to the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were exactly, all about the question of community and
right.
how do you live in the world in such a way that that kind of upholds your own central values. So this project is on attentiveness is an attempt to kind of through my own experience in nature and in thinking about questions surrounding environmental ethics, my own interest in craft and woodworking and the production of kind of human artifacts and human forms of community. It's really kind of an attempt to create a kind of constructive account of for me, like what it means to live in the contemporary world in light of what I take to be the three main problems confronting contemporary humans in most places that have been transformed by globalization and industrialism.
Right.
And those are right. What are we doing in nature, and what does it mean? How do we actually relate to the natural world?
Right.
And what are the sources for how we think about that? And what are the consequences for how we think about nature and how we understand ourselves in connection to the natural world? And then, you know, how is that connected to who we are as, you know, kind of Homo faber, right? Like
a species,
organisms that make things,
yeah.
Right? And what does that mean? And how does culture, kind of the cultural artifacts, and the kind of the whole history of human making, how does that connect to our sense of place, or our place, you know, within nature? Do we still have the capacity, or the spaces in between kind of global economic operations,
mm-hmm.
to create in the vernacular, right? To actually create pieces that belong in a certain place,
as opposed to displaced,
disconnected. Could be anywhere. Could be made anywhere.
Globalized.
Could go for, yeah, exactly.
Right. Like
right.
the
right.
You know, do we create the McBurger?
Exactly.
Or do we create a dish that's
right.
vernacular?
Uh-huh. That's right. You know, and then the next step of that is to kind of think about, okay, what are the implications for how we live in
together?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. How do we live in community? And so for me, those things are all deeply connected.
Interesting.
It's not immediately straightforward how they're connected, but they're connected in terms of every kind of everyday life.
Three things that you build your attention around.
That's right.
In the daily world.
That's right.
I was reading, and I've spoken to you about this briefly. I was reading this book by Kathy Davidson, who
mm-hmm.
works in humanities at Duke and Haystack, and in the English program as well there. And she's written a lot
mm-hmm.
of controversial stuff that challenges how we think about attentiveness,
mm-hmm.
precisely in this new globalized
mm-hmm.
world,
right.
with our reliance on technology.
Right.
And one of the things that she's saying about attentiveness and attention is we need to change the way that we play the game. We
mm-hmm.
need to change the way our schools are structured.
Yep.
We need to change the way pedagogy, learning, and we just basically think about how we pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that she's a proponent for is multitasking.
Right.
Is short-term attention.
That's right.
And is creating new forms of institutions
mm-hmm.
around the new reality.
The reality that calls for multitasking.
Yeah, 140
right.
characters at a time,
yeah,
or,
exactly,
or whatever.
Right. Right.
But it seems like your work with woodworking, right, that's the polar opposite of that.
You better not do too much multitasking. You're going to lose something.
Yeah, it could be literally a painful process.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, what you're pointing to there, what Kathy Davidson, I think, is pointing to is, you know, there are basically like two kind of diverging streams of thought here, and one represents kind of an embrace of technology, as you said, and the desire to kind of to think about attention in terms of what is possible for human beings, and what does the market demand?
Yeah,
right? What is the marketplace demand for how we deploy our attention?
Right.
And so there, like, you know, the mastery of technology for the purpose of multitasking is crucial. And so her proposal is that we have to organize, you know, all of our social institutions around getting ahead of that curve in order to be competitive in the marketplace.
Or else we will fail in the marketplace.
Right. Another stream or another way of thinking about this is, you know, or a kind of a criticism of that is that, or a potential one anyway, is by a guy named Nicholas Carr, who wrote a book called The Shallows, and his argument is that the more we interact with this kind of technology, with the internet in particular, our brains are actually changing, and they're changing in ways that that may cause us to pause a little bit and wonder about questions about not just quantity or how we're participating in the market, but
yeah.
what is the quality of our human life.
Yeah.
And do we actually have the capacity
yeah.
for sustained, attention, whether that sustained attention is to an argument, a task,
yeah.
another person? And, you know, if you look at the, you know, the vast majority of religious traditions, there is, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, most of them have really important teachings
yeah.
that relate to where you put your attention and actually have built-in practices that are intended to create the possibility of sustained attention within a given practitioner. And, you know, and maybe certain religious traditions do this more than others,
right?
Or philosophical traditions. Certainly within kind of the Christian monastic tradition, and certainly within Buddhism, and Taoism, there are, right?
Contemplative
practices, exactly. And to me, that serves as a really important kind of counter or corrective to this, what I worry is a kind of uncritical embrace of the, you know, the requirements of participation in a globalized market that Davidson is sort of advocating for.
But I wonder if the dichotomy can't be bridged in some way.
Yeah.
And let me give you a simple way of putting it without trying to make it too simplistic. The more I use my Twitter account, the more I need time away from my Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Right.
Like the more I participate in this culture, not only do I, the more that I value moving away from society, maybe not in a Dead Sea Scrolls kind of way, but, well, did I just blow your mind? I'm sorry.
You did. Yeah,
should
no,
I
right,
should I have
right.
warned you before I was going to blow your mind?
sorry to interrupt you, but I think that's, in some ways, that's kind of like the... You know, that's the dichotomy that you're left with. You either you become Amish and you eschew all of this stuff,
right? Yeah,
or you find ways to embrace it along a continuum.
And what you've got to do then is be attentive to attention,
right?
Like you've got to actually be aware and be good consumer of these new practices,
right?
And the old ones,
right?
So
and be aware at a level of that, you know, that does kind of presume that. That ability to do some self-criticism.
Yeah.
Right? What am I doing right now?
Yeah.
And how does it fit within my broader set of goals or,
you
know, aspirations?
Yeah.
And so on. So yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, one problem here is that people who study this stuff, I mean, you know, especially from the psychological or neurobiological point of view, have concluded pretty well that, you know, there's really no such thing as multitasking. We are not actually physiologically capable of doing what we think is called multitasking.
So it's just like short-term attention.
Exactly.
Right?
So what we're actually doing is switching our attention rapidly from one thing to another. And the question is, what happens when you start to do that more and more and more and more and more?
Right.
What do you lose?
Right.
That is the question that I have, which I think is a really important, maybe the sort of the question for our era,
right?
Is in the ways that we interact with technology and in the ways in which we participate in kind of, you know, the broader forces of globalization and especially economic ones. What does that do to our attentiveness? And you know, I think the question, like, is that good or bad? Is, you know, is the evaluative question. Is open for debate, but that it's important, or that it's, you know, that there are consequences
right.
one way or the other, I think is not really all that debatable. I think that's the case. The question is whether we as individuals or as, you know, a broader set of of society or societies,
right.
Whether that's what we think is good for, you know, for human flourishing,
right?
And so. Yeah,
but do you think the longer terms, in some sense, what we call the longest term attention is what you said, asceticism, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is like you really do got to withdraw because whether you're in the ancient period, medieval period, modern, or postmodern period, social life of the householder, quote unquote, requires you to shift pretty fast,
right?
From thing to thing. And one thing that has changed is the speed of that.
That's right.
The quantity of it. Do you think the quality, do you think we're living in a time where the quantitative shift has affected a qualitative shift as well, though?
Well,
are we doing things totally differently than we have before, or are we just doing it more and more and more and faster and faster and faster.
I think one way to look at that is to think generationally. You know, all you have to do is ask your parents and your grandparents what has changed.
Yeah.
Right? And what they'll tell you is that things are faster, there's more of it. Again, yeah. at least in the context of, you know, the United States, let's say.
Yeah.
And probably in other, especially, you know, other industrialized or industrializing economies. India, I would imagine, at least in certain circles.
I remember talking to my grandfather about this very question when he was alive. He's since passed on. But I just sort of was like, you know, I just asked him, well, where would you take a train if you needed to get to Kanpur or wherever? Like, because his father did business outside of Punjab. And he would tell me that he would walk from this place to that place, and then I'd be like, really? You would walk?
Yeah, right.
And I'd be like, how many people would you see? And not many, mm-hmm. you know, on that walk. And today, you know, there's many roads mm-hmm. to traverse, many villages to which you've got to travel through, some of which don't even exist anymore. I mean, it's incomparable.
Yeah.
It is incomparable.
Right.
The difference between those
mm-hmm.
two things.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think though that generationally then, like, we're living in an era then that is kind of not comparable to another era?
I think we are. I think that's true. But you know, I think my goal is to try to resist becoming too doctrinaire, you know, about any of this stuff. You know, in other words, I don't wish to be a Luddite. I don't wish to be kind of anti-technology. I recognize that there are a lot of benefits that come.
Well, couldn't be.
I couldn't be and have the job that I have. And
be recorded on a podcast.
Exactly right. That's right. We could be sitting in a cave right now. And, you know, maybe people would start flocking around us like Benedict or something. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's the paradox. And
some of that is
the paradox that we live with.
Yeah.
And it's a question of how we navigate it and how we, you know, as individuals, but also kind of more broadly, how much attention are we actually paying to the trade-offs?
Yeah.
You know, when we introduce this or that new element of social or economic life. And I think,
right.
you know, all you have to do is is walk around our campus.
Yeah.
And just watch how people are... Watch what people are paying attention to.
Right.
And that's going to look very different from what it looked like even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that, you know, again, that's a technological thing.
Right.
My point is not, we shouldn't have smartphones or we shouldn't have this or that thing. My point is, like, what are we actually doing? Like, how intentional are we about what we're doing at any given moment? Are we aware of the kinds of little micro decisions that we're making
mm-hmm.
every moment? And what does it actually benefit us? What does it bring us if we become more aware?
Mm-hmm.
And if we become more aware, like, how do we do that? Is it by instituting practices that help us do that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it by, you know, setting a little alarm every 2 minutes, you know, that tells you to, you know, yeah, pay attention to what you're doing? I guess different people will have different approaches to that, but I think that's the question that I continue to be interested in is...
Well, let me ask you the question then.
Yeah.
Is that in nature, in your own creative practice,
yeah.
and in the communities that you've participated in, mm-hmm. what joys, what positive experiences have you been opened up to since you've been thinking of this project in this way?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, good question. Well, I'll start with the nature question. I think you know, when I first started thinking about this, I was thinking really in terms of the those moments that I think most people have had, with perhaps the exception of really, you know, underprivileged urban children. of being in nature,
mm-hmm.
however you define that, whether that's standing in the middle of a prairie or on the mountaintop or at the ocean, right? And having an experience of you know, expansiveness,
mm-hmm.
right? There's something bigger here that mm-hmm. I'm part of. There's mm-hmm. something that's outside of me that, you know, what the romantics would have understood as kind of like the sublime,
mm-hmm.
right? That moment where you're just confronted with majesty and mystery and mm-hmm. it's all, right? Like, I started out kind of being interested in that question And what would it mean to pay attention to ourselves in nature in that way? But then that kind of got complicated by my awareness that, you know, a lot of how we think about that question really rests on how we understand our relationship to nature in the first place. And so mm-hmm. there are all kinds of underlying cultural values and assumptions.
Just unpacking the word nature.
Just unpacking the word nature or wilderness or right. Right,
as opposed to
environment or any of these things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That are going to shape what that experience can be like.
Right.
And furthermore, what does it mean to pay attention in wilderness or in nature when we are basically kind of systematically in the process of reconfiguring whole ecologies as human organisms, right, or as human populations? So then my question about attention in nature really became one of, okay, well, how do we pay attention to the stuff that we're doing in ways that are totally disrupting?
Right.
You know, like, what does it mean to pay attention to the extinction crisis?
Yeah.
You know, and to really take seriously what are the responsibilities that we might have to pay attention in that way, not just, hey, isn't nature great and isn't it beautiful and aren't I having a wonderful experience?
Right.
So trying to kind of sort through some of that in that part of the book. As far as the woodworking or the craft part, you know, I found that my early woodworking experiences were really beset by impatience and by an inability to sustain attention long enough to really do something well. And so woodworking has taught me a lot about the importance of waiting, right? Listening, taking time, paying attention to things that wouldn't necessarily be obvious, like what is the pattern of the grain calling for here, right? Or how can I be sure that I construct this particular joint in such a way that it's going to really retain kind of maximum strength and beauty? And
that's beautiful, because you're creating something, you're in the process of creating something
that's right
that comes from nature,
that's right,
but you're forward thinking to its use,
that's right,
in the way that you're being created to it.
Right.
So you actually have to pay attention not to the present moment,
right,
but through the present moment to several different moments.
Exactly right.
I feel like is the crux of so many problems that we've been talking about.
That's today. Exactly right. And I think and a lot of people have written about this, you know, about how the process of craft, or the learning of a kind of discipline, right? We use the language of discipline,
yeah,
right, which is quite quite deliberate, I think. Like that discipline requires this kind of discipline, and what you're actually shaping in the process is not just a piece of wood or a piece of furniture, but you're shaping the self, right? You're actually kind of conditioning your own self, your own selfhood. I mean, that's certainly my experience. My woodworking has been my teacher in many ways about my own, about my own personality.
Right.
And has exposed aspects of my own personality that I didn't necessarily know were there.
Brought to your attention.
And brought them to my attention. Impatience,
right?
My inability to really focus on something very long.
Right.
And has kind of insisted, gently along the way, hey, back off. Take your time. Be patient.
Right.
Do this right the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old adage, like measure twice, cut once, yeah, right? That has been really transformative for me in a way that has impacted all other aspects of my life, my scholarship, my teaching, my interactions with other human beings, I hope, just generally kind of ways of being in the world. And so it's that, but that's what I would call a practice.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't have to be woodworking. It doesn't have to be anything that we would call a craft, but
right,
a practice of some sort,
right,
that one undertakes in order to, to not just produce something, but to also, be shaped, be transformed. And maybe that sounds very mystical,
No, but
you can probably take that too far,
you know, and it suddenly becomes about, you know, becomes about me or about the self too much. And I think there are limits there. But I think if we have to, there's a reason why, you know, why human beings have been speaking in this way about, about craft and about making and art and so on, for millennia.
Well, it's, right? That's a really interesting move that you just made right there, because what you've, not only have you sort of gone to the third part of what you're doing and become aware of yourself in a community of craftsmen,
that's right,
or
yeah,
or society in general or other relationships, you're also meditating on what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
Not just now, not just Sam Thomas today,
right,
but you're trying to link up to what it meant to be human a millennia ago in a different time and place.
Yeah, I think that's true, although within a, I would say in a very qualified way, like I...
Always, right?
Always, yeah. And I think that's the key, you know, that people, myself included, would be hesitant to speak these days about the human condition, right? Even though...
And yet... If we don't...
Right.
Right? What's the point?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And maybe ultimately you decide, you know, like Kathy Davidson, yes, the ideal human condition is one in which we are multitasking all the time so as to be competitive in the global marketplace.
Or
maybe that's what you decide.
Or or so as to increase the amount of interactions that you have, even if they're highly qualitative, highly, you know, quality interactions, so that you increase your social structures and social capital and those kinds of things.
Absolutely,
it doesn't have to be just for marketplace.
No, it doesn't. And right, absolutely. And I have to say, like, there are some aspects of her arguments that I really like, that I find really compelling.
Yeah.
That I don't mean to be too critical about that, but yeah, I think that's right. There's a way in which at least I'm trying to do in this project, in this book, is to integrate a lot of research, a lot of scholarship on these different areas, through my own experience and into my own voice, as a way of saying, okay, here's where I, this one person who inhabits this one place in time and place, have to say about this. So that's kind of my goal, and I think that's, you know, that to me, that's been a really exciting experience, to try on that kind of writing and that kind of scholarship, you know, and to move away a little bit from the more academic, more rarefied kind of, you know, discourse around the Dead Sea Scrolls, even though I'm still invested in that and still participate in that.
Well, the communities that you're talking to, there still could be overlapping, but it seems somewhat distinct what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the tools that you're using aren't, you know, you haven't dropped your, you know, your critical lens that you picked up here.
Yeah, and not at all.
You're picking up on these really rich conversations about human life today.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. And I think, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are thinking a lot about this kind of stuff. And I think, you know, there are other really good books out there that, you know, that deal with similar things just in different ways. And
what should we read if we were going to look at a couple?
Oh, you should read, Matthew Crawford's book, Shop Class as Soul Craft.
Uh-huh.
You should read Richard Sennett's book, The Craftsman. You should read anything by Kathleen Dean Moore in her kind of philosophical meditations on nature. You should read anything by Columba Stewart on Benedictine community.
Ah.
The list just goes on and on. Anything by Robert Pogue Harrison on the human condition is worth a read.
Yeah.
So this project has just been so much fun, because I just get to read all my favorite things and all my favorite people and to create a conversation with them in the process of writing this book. So
part of me wants to do what one does at this point and say, well, when is this book going to be available? But that's exactly the wrong question, because what we should allow you to do is have that fun, and when the book does become available, hope that we can partake in the enjoyment of what you're working on here.
That's right. Yeah, if I just, you know, if I could just stop looking at my cell phone so often.